Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. Joining me as always is Tom Uren. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Patrick. How are you?
Good, good. And we would like to thank our sponsor this week, Trail of Bits, who is supporting all of the work that Tom and Catalin are doing here at Risky Biz HQ, in Risky Business News, and Seriously Risky Business, all of those newsletters and podcasts. So big thanks to them. They're a security engineering firm based in the United States. And of course, we'd also like to say a big old thank you to the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative, who have supported this work for a long, long time now. So cheerio to you too. Tom, we're going to talk about a couple of things this week. The first thing we're going to talk about is we're going to recap a little bit the interview that I did with Ilya Vichuk, who is the head of cyber for Ukraine's SBU agency. That was a big feature interview that I did with Dmitry Alperovich. It was like a joint production between Geopolitics Decanted, his podcast, and Risky Business, my podcast. And the other thing we're going to talk about today are some efforts from the United States government to secure open source software, which I think are very, very, it's a great thing. It's a very positive thing, but I'm keen to get your take on it.
Yeah.
So let's kick off the discussion now. You know, this is an interview that we published here on Monday. We also discussed it in the weekly show with Adam Boileau briefly, but I definitely wanted to give, I definitely wanted to get your thoughts on it, because basically what I was doing when I interviewed Ilya Vichuk is to ask him about things that you had written in your newsletter to sort of ask for his evaluation of your opinions, basically. And largely it felt like your analysis has been bang on. Like everything he said was sort of consistent with your analysis over the last year or so. I mean, I'm guessing you took that away from the interview as well.
Yeah, so it's kind of an occupational danger when you are employed to have opinions about stuff that you'll inevitably get things wrong. And I think particularly in the case of a proper war, like there's the fog of war. So it was, I've got to say it was gratifying to find that I think a lot of the things that I had thought were basically reinforced or video agreed with. So I think particularly one thing has been just how coordinated Russian actions have been. So there was a couple of times where Vidyuk spoke about the coordination between Russian military, like conventional military actions, and Russian cyber operations. And so one of them was that there's a time when energy companies were being attacked by missiles and destructive cyber operations were launched at the same time. And my position was, look, that's a kind of synchronized tasking, but that's not coordination. You're not making one thing better by having cyber as an additive extra on top. You're just trying to do the same thing. And his take was that that's kind of how the Soviets would have operated. Yeah. I think
he said these people have missiles that miss 80% of the time, and he's probably overstating that figure, but you know, he's making the point that their doctrine seems to be to just go with ridiculous force and hope something works, and you know, which is kind of what you'd written. And you know, yours was not necessarily the majority voice on that either. People have been, I think people in the cybers, right, get very excited when there's cyber stuff happening and have said, oh, look, it's, you know, synchronized attacks with packets and bombs and missiles at the same time. But really, when you look at it, the reality seems to be a little less sophisticated.
Yeah, so there was another part where he talked about timing. So he broadly said that since 2014, that cyber attacks against Ukraine have been kind of on a constant up and up. But in particular, in the month before the actual full-on invasion, he said that Russia launched a number of very large attacks. And he talked about, you know, defacement, wipers, lockers, DDoS attacks, and also a psychological campaign at the same time. And so this sort of answered one of my questions about it, is why would you launch that kind of attack in the weeks leading up to your actual ground invasion? Why not launch it simultaneously? And Vidyuk's view was that they were doing it because they wanted to kind of win a psychological war, And so if those attacks had been successful, the idea was that you would have caused a whole lot of disruption. And in a way, these are my words, not his, destroy the will of the people to fight.
Yeah.
In the lead up to the war. And so that kind of makes sense.
The way you described it, it was almost like attempted cyber shock and awe, but it kind of felt a bit flat, really.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it kind of backfired in that when you repel those attacks, people just feel that,
emboldened, right?
Like, yeah, that's right. Well, you feel united against a common enemy and you feel that you're doing well. And so that, to me, makes sense as a rationale for why you would have those attacks before, because you're focused on the psychological aspects rather than the actual
operational aspects,
empowering your military on the day. I mean, they did other things to empower the military on the day, like the Viasat attack. I thought it was interesting he very briefly mentioned that they'd adapted to that attack within 5 or 6 hours. So he didn't go into details of what they'd done, but presumably, I don't know, they had some backup or they just want to
sound like...
Well,
I'm guessing that was a process. I mean, I actually had a discussion with Dimitri after we did that interview about exactly that he said. And it's like, well, you know, he can't have meant that they got their Viasat terminals back up and running because they were bricked, right? So they obviously mitigated it, you know, some other way by rolling everyone onto LTE or something. I don't know. But yeah, I found that interesting as well, where they said ultimately that Viasat attack, which has filled many, many column inches, didn't really result in an operational disruption.
Yeah, another interesting thing is he said that there's attacks going on all the time. And he mentioned an attempted attack on one of their big telcos. So he said that they have 3 telcos. If you manage to take out one, that's actually pretty catastrophic, because it's hard to fail over effectively when a third of your capacity is gone. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Another thing I picked out was that he talked about deploying hackers closer to the front lines. So the reasons he gave were to facilitate communication with the Russian military, get better access to military devices captured on the battlefield, Ukrainian devices, and also access Ukrainian infrastructure in occupied territories. So those 3 reasons totally make sense. But and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I got the feeling that part of the physical relocation was to sort of compensate for poor communication between the Russian military and the actual
cyber
hacking
operators, right? Yeah. No, I get that. But I mean, I don't think we'd be much different, you know, in the Western militaries and stuff. I think actually having people there makes a difference. And I will say too that I had read previously, I can't remember where I read this, I'm very sorry, but I had read of cases where the Russians would capture a territory that included like a data center, and then, you know, Russian operators would enter that data center and then use its privileged access to spam wipers anywhere they could, because they were on the other side of a trust boundary, right? So if you could get into a data center, physically access a machine that had trusted access to other machines outside of that area, then you could actually do some damage that way. So they were definitely doing that. But again, this just seems like, you know, that the strategy is just do as much damage as you can. There's nothing really sophisticated about it. You know what I mean?
So, you know, you are taking advantage of an on-the-ground action to advance your cyber operations. But most of the time, the cyber operations aren't reinforcing the conventional ones. Or, in fact, I've never seen any example where they have, except for the Viasat one.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's interesting that, like, you know, do as much damage as possible, and that seems to be what you're trying to do. It just, I don't know, it's not what we were expecting. And that's something that really came through in that interview too, is that, you know, what Ukraine got in this full-scale invasion is probably not what entire industry of cyber pundits predicted it would get. You know, we predicted that their ATMs wouldn't work, and that their banking sector would be attacked, and their critical infrastructure would be, you know, under tremendously sophisticated attacks. You know, we saw InDestroyer and Triton and Trisis and, you know, power stations going down historically, and we just haven't seen much of that. Of course, there would have been stuff, there has undoubtedly been stuff that has targeted Ukraine that we don't know about, that has succeeded. But all in all, I think the cyber war that we got was not the cyber war that we expected. And Ukraine probably performed a little bit better than we're expecting, and Russia probably performed a little bit worse than we're expecting. I mean, that's my takeaway from all of this.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Ilya said that really they'd had 8 years of preparation. And he did make the point that against a different country, perhaps the outcome would be different, or the impact would be different. And so 8 years of preparation, that really does seem to me very significant, in that if you're feeling that there's a realistic threat that you're having to deal with every day, and he described it as pretty much every day, you do get a lot better and a lot more adept at handling that. And I think that there's still the opportunity for these kinds of attacks to make a significant difference if you haven't been training the other side for a huge amount of time.
Anyway, the whole thing was pretty interesting. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I certainly was trying to ask the questions that would satisfy you, Tom. That was definitely what I was trying to do through that whole experience. Another thing we want to talk about today, you've done a great write-up of the CSRB's Lapsus report, so that's in this week's newsletter as well for you to read, for people to read. But another thing that you briefly touched on, and I wanted to talk about this with you, is the US government seems to be looking at how it can best support open source software and best secure it. This is stuff, I mean, we've seen various governments take little stabs at this over the years, but it really does feel like the US government now is just trying to do an awful lot, you know, when it looks at, you know, how can we secure our supply chain? And I think the Log4j thing was a really important event, because it made governments say, oh, okay, right, this is probably a problem that'll bite us on our ass. So do you also get the sense that it's different this time, and that they're serious about it and they're actually going to do something meaningful?
I think that they are doing things. So how serious can you be? I guess the question is. So the two particular things I picked out over the last couple of weeks were, the White House launched a 2-year competition led by DARPA. And so what they've put is $20 million in prizes. And the idea is that they'll try and get AI assistance to help write code that's more secure. So I think that is absolutely a thing that will make a difference. And partly that's because I hear a lot of people are writing code with AI assistance and it's actually useful. I think you could make those assistants more security savvy, like actually pretty easily. That's my guess.
I think that DARPA project is also there to use AI to find bugs in existing code as well. I don't think it's just for assistance.
Yeah, and I had an interview with Dan Guido of Trail of Bits, and we talked about this, and he actually
thinks
it will
be. This is right up Dan's alley.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, that's actually a pretty small amount of money in the US government's, in terms of the US government's budget. I think that'll make a difference. The other thing I spoke about was really a request for information on ways to help secure open source software. So the good part is that the request said, you know, this is potentially like the US interstate highway system, where we make a massive investment and the returns are also huge. So of course, it's made that analogy. It said, raise the specter of a potential huge investment, but it doesn't actually commit any money. It's just like, what are the ideas that are out there? So your question was,
that could be a step on the way to money being allocated, right? Like, this is the first step.
Yes. So your question was, how serious are they? And I think, well, they're potentially
working that out.
Serious.
Yeah.
they're
figuring out how serious they're going to be. Yeah. So that's CISA and the White House who've put out that call. But it just does feel like, I think, you know, after some of these big things happened, like, I mean, SolarWinds, you know, not much to do with open source, but you look at SolarWinds, Log4j, stuff like that. I think that really got policymakers in the US government in particular to go, okay, you know, we need to start thinking about our supply chains. And I think Log4j showed them that, you know, the open source supply chain is incredibly important. And I think they're addressing some of the commercial supply chain stuff with, you know, some of these new roadmaps that CIS has put out for what vendors need to be doing. And the, you know, the implication is that eventually the US government's going to stop buying stuff that doesn't comply with CIS's way of doing things. So I don't know. I feel like They're on their way to being serious. Maybe not serious yet.
Some of those things that you mentioned are actually serious as well. Like, I think that's a commitment to do things that will make a difference in the ecosystem. And even things like software bill of materials. I think these are all things that shape the environment in a better way. So I think, like, yes, that is serious. I guess my question is, how much money is serious? But at this point, I don't think people are even sure that money is the solution. A request for information.
You need to have an idea of how to spend it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
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 All right, Tom Uren, thank you very much for joining me for this edition of the Seriously Risky Business podcast. People can head over to risky.biz/subscribe to find a link to your wonderful weekly newsletter, Seriously Risky Biz. But that's it for today's recording, mate, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks a lot, Pat.